Good morning to you all, and welcome to the third lecture of the 2019 Palliative Care Lecture Series. Hospice New Zealand would like to thank and acknowledge Cancer Research Trust New Zealand for their generous support and funding to deliver these free lectures. The lecture today will be recorded, and it will be available on the Hospice New Zealand website. Please be aware there will be an opportunity for questions at the end of the presentation. We would now like to introduce our guest speakers today, Prudence Lennox, Director of Nursing, and Kim Fuller, National Program Lead Registered Nurse for IDEA Services, IHC. Please welcome Prudence and Kim. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My name's Prue, and on the line co-presenting we have Kim. So thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you today. It's a privilege to be able to share our experiences in the disability sector with you all. So looking at slide two, today we're going to reflect on where the intellectual disability sector has come from, where it is now, and what we hope to achieve in the future with a focus on palliative care and end-of-life support. IDEA Services is specialised at providing community-based support for people with intellectual disability. Hospice and other palliative care services in the community are the experts at providing palliative and end-of-life care. So we need each other in order to provide excellent services for the people we support on their journey to end-of-life. This is a complex area for us, and we will discuss some of the reasons for this and where we would like to see our services improving for these individuals in the future. We're speaking to you today on behalf of IDEA Services IHC. Therefore, this content is not necessarily representative of the wider disability sector's experiences and views. So moving to slide three, it is helpful for you to understand the history of support services for people with intellectual disability, both internationally and in New Zealand, to better understand where some misconceptions or misunderstandings may have come from. Challenging the model of support started in the 1940s and gained international and local momentum through the 1980s. Real traction for change has progressed since 2003, when community inclusion was formally endorsed in New Zealand. So that's about 16 years ago. It's still a relatively new concept which has been evolving ever since. You can follow the journey from a medical model of support to where we have progressed to now with a psychosocial community integrated model. It is of interest to highlight that deinstitutionalisation is primarily a first world concept, and in particular is popular in only a few countries: Canada, the UK, Australia and New Zealand. This puts some context to how important it is to educate people in our workforce who are new to New Zealand's disability model about where and how people live. Many people with intellectual disabilities live with their own families, independently, or with private carers. IDEA Services is the largest and one of many residential service providers. New Zealand no longer has institutions. Moving to slide four, about us. So as our mission states, IHC will advocate for the rights, inclusion and welfare of all people with intellectual disabilities and support them to live satisfying lives in the community. Our values are inclusion, responsiveness, support and empowerment. We believe in people and our behaviours drive the way we work to achieve our mission. Two areas I'd like to specifically mention are working together to seek strong partnerships, encourage inclusion in the community and learn from each other. And the other is try new ways, where we strive to be open to new ideas, be open to feedback and become more capable. These two themes are very relevant when it comes to our discussion today. So IDEA Services is the residential service delivery arm of IHC. So moving to slide five. We'd like to take the opportunity to give you some insights into the people we support and discuss some national health data that gives evidence to the challenges that we are experiencing in our services. So IDEA Services supports 3,372 people in 625 homes across New Zealand, from Invercargill to Kaitaia. In 2011, the Ministry of Health conducted a health indicators study and report about New Zealanders with and without intellectual disabilities. The report's study population consisted of 4,261,600 people, and altogether nearly 32,000 people of the study population were classified as having an intellectual disability. So here is some very relevant data about the health status and inequalities that people with intellectual disability experience. So from that report, people with intellectual disability were more likely to live in the most socioeconomically deprived areas of New Zealand. Males had an average life expectancy of only 59 years, which is more than 18 years less than the life expectancy of all New Zealand males at the time, which was 78. And females with an intellectual disability had life expectancy of only 59 years, which is 23 years less than the life expectancy of New Zealand females at the time, which was 82 years. In IDEA services, the average age is 50, with the largest group being men between 50 to 60 years of age, which you can see in the bottom graph. This is significant when we're discussing palliative and end-of-life care. Currently, IDEA services are supporting nearly 1,500 people between 50 and 70 years of age. So that's 1,500 people who are within the average life expectancy range. And we also experience end-of-life care across the lifespan and support younger service users. The increased use of health services is also evidenced in this Ministry of Health report. Compared to people without intellectual disability, people with an intellectual disability were about 1.5 times more likely to receive treatment for one or more chronic health conditions. They were 1.5 times more likely to receive treatment for chronic respiratory disease. They were twice as likely to receive treatment for coronary heart disease. 1.5 times more likely to receive treatment for cancer. And an area that we're focusing on was also evidenced here, that people with an intellectual disability were over 4 times more likely to have hospital admissions that could have been avoided. We also experience early onset dementia in our services, and the data clearly supports this, stating people with an intellectual disability were at least 10 times more likely to receive care or treatment for dementia in every age group over 35 years. And also people with an intellectual disability were nearly 1.5 times more likely to consult their GP in a 3-month period and were likely to be dispensed almost twice as many different types of prescription drugs. For all indicators examined in this report, people with an intellectual disability were more disadvantaged in terms of their health and life expectancy. They experienced higher rates of specific health conditions and used health services more. Where the rates were lower for this population is the use of screening and health prevention services, which Kim will discuss shortly. So moving to slide 6. A significant milestone in the history of the disability sector that is still a key driver behind service design and delivery and decision making today is the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which was adopted on the 13th of December 2006 at the United Nations headquarters in New York. There were 82 signatories to the convention, and this is the highest number of signatories in history for a UN convention on its opening day. It is the first comprehensive human rights treaty of the 21st century and entered into force on the 3rd of May 2008. The convention follows decades of work by the United Nations to change attitudes and approaches to persons with disabilities. It takes to a new height the movement from viewing persons with disabilities as objects of charity, medical treatment, and social protection towards viewing people with disabilities as subjects with rights who are capable of claiming those rights and making decisions for their lives based on their free and informed consent as well as being active members of society. The convention is intended as a human rights instrument with an explicit social development dimension, It adopts a broad categorisation of persons with disabilities and reaffirms that all persons with all types of disabilities must enjoy all human rights and fundamental freedoms. It clarifies and qualifies how all categories of rights apply to persons with disabilities and identifies areas where adaptations have to be made for persons with disabilities to effectively exercise their rights, and areas where their rights have been violated and where protection of their rights must be reinforced. So moving to slide 7. Before we discuss the health and well-being of people we support in relation to end-of-life care, it's important to understand the legal, ethical, and psychosocial impacts that we experience. IDEA Services are a provider of residential services and supported living. This is not specifically a clinical contract that encompasses medical management as a contractual responsibility or expected outcome. Our contract differs from aged residential care homes in this respect, whereby some aspects of health and wellbeing in that setting are expected to be managed by the facility's health professionals as part of their funding and service models. Our service users have the same entitlement to primary care, secondary and specialist services as the general population would living in their own homes. Our role is to advocate and support our service users to access these services in a timely manner in a collaborative way in order to support the best outcome for their health and well-being. A significant proportion of the people we support do not have any family, whānau or natural supports. So by default, we become their circle of support, but have no legal jurisdiction for giving consent to medical decisions to provide or withdraw interventions and treatments. Enduring power of attorney and welfare guardianship are often misunderstood. We experience challenges navigating consent where there is a lack of EPOA or welfare guardianship and where there's a misunderstanding around competence and the ability to provide consent. Some DHBs have implemented broad policies requiring these processes to be enforced, even when informed consent can be gained, meaning that some service users have been unable to receive medical treatment they need. IHC do provide advocacy advice on a case-by-case basis, but IHC is not automatically the welfare guardian or have EPOA for our service users. It's important to understand that family members are not automatically welfare guardians either. It's a legal process and, if granted, only lasts a maximum of 3 years. When informed consent cannot be gained and EPOA or welfare guardianship is not in place, health professionals must follow a clear, transparent, collaborative and well-documented process before any decisions can be made on behalf of someone with a disability. Court order involvement may also be required. Advanced care planning. We understand that it is best practice to have advanced care plans in place for our service users. But at times this is challenging for us, as some of the people we support may have difficulty with comprehension of non-concrete concepts and have health literacy challenges. We often advocate for people with disabilities to establish their advanced care plan in a timely manner due to the lack of expertise in other areas to initiate these conversations in advance. So often we will be developing an end-of-life care plan before an advanced care plan has ever been put in place. Modern medicine and people's expectations. The desire for endless treatment options, hanging on to miracle cures promoted by media, giving false hope to people about what can be achieved is a challenge for us to support our service users, their family and whānau. An example of this is initiating or continuing PEG feeding when someone can no longer swallow safely or where there is a systemic failure to absorb nutrients. We are part of the wider multidisciplinary team that are often faced with the really hard ethical decisions that requires that person-centred, collaborative approach to ensure that all perspectives have been considered. I'd now like to hand over to Kim to discuss the health and well-being of the people we support in relation to palliative care and end of life.
Good morning, everybody. My name's Kim Fuller, and I'm the Program Lead Registered Nurse for IDF Services IHC. So we'll start with slide 8. My contribution for this presentation this morning, I will be focusing on the more clinical, person-centred, and operational aspects of palliative care for people with intellectual disability. I'll highlight a few of the challenges and considerations we see as important, starting with health inequalities and delayed diagnosis. For example, access for people with intellectual disability accessing basic health and wellness screening programs such as cervical screening, prostate exams, dental checkups, podiatry and optometry exams, radiological screening such as CT and MRI or biopsy procedures, which often require a great deal of planning, cooperation and time. As previously referenced in the 2011 Ministry of Health report, people with intellectual disabilities are less likely to receive health screening services than the general population, but have considerably more incidence of chronic health conditions. Which leads to the next point on the slide, incidental diagnosis versus screening and active investigation. Any of these mentioned screening tests or processes or procedures, or even a blood test, may require a general anaesthetic to complete safely. This can be due to extreme phobias, anxiety or PTSD, or due to other challenging individual circumstances. So tests may be delayed or simply not happen. They're put in the too hard basket. Diagnostic overshadowing is when something is assumed to be from a particular origin rather than knowing the root cause of the presentation. For example, early onset cognitive impairment is often interpreted as a challenging behaviour as part of the intellectual disability diagnosis, as opposed to a new symptom or disease process. So, may not be diagnosed as per the rest of the population in relation to investigating a new self-reported symptom, but get picked up when something else happens or an acute presentation is looked into. The loss of many medical records occurred as part of the approach to deinstitutionalisation. One contributing factor to this was that many people moved out of the area health board they were living in while in the institution, and their paper-based records simply did not follow them. And without family involvement, there can be a lack of family medical history, which can lead to delays in diagnostics and identification of high-risk hereditary conditions such as bowel cancer. Lack of intellectual disability specialists. DHBs taking an inconsistent approach to providing intellectual disability and or dual disability teams. So in some circumstances, there can be a lack of both resource or tertiary advice. Dual disability is when someone has both an intellectual disability and a diagnosed mental health disorder. There is not a focus in New Zealand on undergraduate courses on intellectual disability or dual disability specifically, or even disability generally. There are some syndrome-specific conditions which can contribute to health complexity. Some of the people we support have a diagnosed syndrome, so it is valuable to consider some of the common related aspects. However, I will point out that not everybody with a specific syndrome has all of these aspects to their diagnosis. People with intellectual disability share the same health vulnerabilities as the rest of the population. In addition, they may have risks associated with a particular syndrome that underlie their intellectual disability or syndrome. We will discuss some examples of associated complicating factors for some of these syndromes and conditions. Start with a syndrome called Prader-Willi syndrome. It has associated impulse control difficulties, hypertonia, severe obesity, and type 2 diabetes associated with it. There's Fragile X syndrome. people with Fragile X often have ADHD or traits of autism and difficulty with social functioning. They may have epilepsy, aortic dilation, or mitral valve dysplasia. Sturge-Weber syndrome is a variable clinical phenomena depending on the site of the angioma or hemangioma, mainly of the skin and meninges. There's a condition called neurofibromatosis, and that has a variable clinical phenomena depending on the site of the tumours and skeletal abnormalities. In this condition, the tumours are susceptible to malignant change. In tuberous sclerosis, there can be tumours of the retina, also cardiac rhabdomyomas, kidney and lung hematomas, and polycystic kidneys. And in Down syndrome, there are some complications as well. Often people with Down syndrome can have sensory impairments, thyroid disorders, Alzheimer's type dementia, and early onset of this, and congenital heart disease, blood dyscrasia, hypoplastic pharynx, and obesity. Behavior disturbances, although not a syndrome, can impact hugely on health outcomes. For example, someone with autism may be challenged with a change in routine or by meeting new people who are part of their care regime or team. Which leads to the final point on this slide, communication styles. It is vital to make reasonable adjustments for place of appointment for the slow pace or repetition that may be required for health promotion, assessment, and or intervention, or have easy read resources available to support understanding and informed decision making. Often resources are in multiple languages, but not also in an appropriate easy read format. It can be time consuming to allow the necessary time and can be costly to adapt environments or resources accordingly, but good communication and working together is essential. Moving to the next slide, slide number 9. It's helpful to understand how intersecting services operate. So our residential services in the community have between 1 and 6 people living in each home. Funding is sought on an individual basis via needs assessment agencies, such as Takura Trust in Auckland. Each home is staffed by support workers who do career force support worker training modules and IDEA services specific modules. A group of homes will be overseen by a service manager. We have recently started employing some registered health professionals as service managers as a new initiative to begin to meet our changing needs, but not yet in all towns or cities. We have a clinical governance which consists of us, through the Director of Nursing, myself as the program lead registered nurse, as well as 1 program lead speech language therapist and 2 clinical psychologists. We would expect our workforce to have similar levels of health literacy as the rest of the population, and we support this to grow with internal initiatives such as communities of practice, which targets service managers, and the information filters down through the organisation. But primarily, the focus is not on delivering medical services. Direction and delegation plays a key role in our organisation. Health professionals from community-based services, such as hospice and district nursing, often require our support workers and workforce to assist with tasks that fit within this model and are deemed tax-safe to delegate. The Nursing Council of New Zealand clearly outlines the decision-making process that should be followed before a nurse delegates a task to someone else, and IDEA services work within this at all times. We have a belief that collaborative practice and partnership will ensure best health comes through mutual respect, well-documented protocols and guidelines for decision-making, and clearly defined levels of accountability. It is important that as health professionals, you all understand the roles and responsibilities and what this means within a service like ours. As we do not hold a clinical contract to deliver nursing services as such, we cannot teach, deem competent, or own the direction and delegation for these tasks to our support workers. Examples of this are dressings, advanced catheter management, or emergency management of gastro tubes. We fully support the hospice and district nurses through these processes, enabling training and ensuring your ongoing oversight is easy and well communicated to our teams. We will work with you to ensure that core skills deemed essential to deliver a task are attained and the context on which the scope of these skills can be utilised by support workers is clearly documented, and that ongoing delegation and supervision are structured and functioning safely. Where this can be very challenging is when interventions such as PRN medications are prescribed, which require a degree of clinical assessment and knowledge, especially when regimes might change quickly, such as an end-of-life care. And when medical interventions such as complex dressings, subcutaneous or intramuscular injections, or syringe drivers are required. This is where we rely very heavily on our community medical health partners to work within our policy and guidelines and workforce scope of practice. Moving to the next slide, slide number 10, our experiences of end-of-life care. Due to the nature of health complexities and ageing statistics for the people we are supporting, we often find ourselves delivering services towards the end of life. We do have an end-of-life policy, and with the right support, in most cases, the ability to provide dignified end-of-life experiences. We have usually had better experiences when we have had early engagement with our external partners, time to build rapport, capacity, skills, and comfort levels. Home visiting services have been an essential part of our positive experience, allowing a deeper understanding of our strengths and our limitations, reducing fear and anxiety for all concerned with coaching, training, targeted at the needs of the individuals, and expert pain management and advice within our workforce scope and capability. And extremely valued has been the really excellent post-bereavement support for people's housemates and staff alike. I'd like to put some of these points into perspective with an example. In one of our larger cities, we were supporting a woman in her early 50s who had Down syndrome, early onset, early stage Alzheimer's dementia, COPD, and metastatic breast cancer. Let's call her Sue. Sue's cancer was diagnosed following an initial finding from a chest X-ray that was being done to investigate possible aspiration pneumonia. It appeared that Sue was having some trouble at the time remembering how to get dressed and was withdrawing from social activities, but she was well aware that she was very sick and that sometimes people die from cancer. She was very used to being in hospital as a patient, as she had experienced various complications over the years from her COPD and also from visiting her elderly mother when she had been in hospital. Following the diagnosis and various other tests, for which Sue was very cooperative, a multidisciplinary team and family meeting was held with Sue, her siblings, and the service manager from the house where she lived. This multidisciplinary team engaged the GP early, as requested by Sue's siblings. A long and very patient process followed, led by her GP. The GP took this lead as he already had a long-standing relationship with Sue, as opposed to the specialist at the hospital who were strangers to her. The GP explained treatment options to decide on the best way forward for Sue. Some treatment was commenced, but was very poorly tolerated by Sue, with no improvement in prognosis. Eventually, after 3 months and more multidisciplinary team and family meetings, always with Sue involved, she she decided that she did not want any more treatment. It was determined that the early onset dementia was not affecting her decision making around her cancer, according to her GP, and this was agreed by her family and the support team who knew her well. Service manager, who was not a registered health professional, but very keen to learn and guide her team, was actively enabled and guided by the GP to engage early with community partners. Support workers found learning new skills through home visit coaching sessions and information about palliative and end-of-life care from the Hospice New Zealand Fundamentals modules they completed extremely empowering. A shared care service agreement ensued between district nursing, the local hospice, and was supported by the GP. A clear direction and delegation model was implemented, and alternatives to complex breakthrough medication regimes were implemented in the final stages of care. These included fentanyl patches and nasal sprays instead of top-ups to syringe driver regimes, which support workers were struggling with. A well-controlled and communicated plan made Sue's wish to be cared for and die at home possible. The family stayed over in a converted spare room if they wanted to, and housemates came and went into Sue's room as they felt comfortable or curious as to what was happening. This wraparound support enabled Sue and the team to have a dignified and positive experience. Service manager and team have since expressed a willingness to do this type of support again. All in all, a very positive experience and journey. Moving to the next slide, slide 11. However, the reality is that at sometimes we experience challenges. We find it very challenging waiting for referrals to palliative care services when we know that early engagement has better outcomes. It sometimes feels like our access is not equitable because some referrals have a belief that the people we support are already in a service. But as we have discussed, our focus in this service model is not a medical focus. So we really need the experts to engage early and work with us. Our policy and guidelines and documentation allow for us to plan once a life-limiting condition is diagnosed. But again, as we have discussed, this is not always straightforward either. When support needs change for an individual, it can be complicated to determine if the main change and new need is primarily caused by a medical issue or due to pre-existing disability. And then there's discussions about who will fund the support needs. Now I'd like to share with you a very different story to demonstrate some of these challenges. This is about a man in his late 40s who lived in one of our larger regional centres. Let's call him Ted. Ted had global developmental delay from an unknown cause. He required support to organise his day and to keep safe around the home and in the community, but was very mobile and active, enjoying special topics and being outdoors. He communicated with a few spoken words and phrases, but most of his communication was non-verbal in nature, laughing, crying, pushing people away or hugging them close, choosing to be involved or not to be involved in activities. He had one sister who lived overseas and was not in touch very often. He also had a rapidly growing, fungating tumour for which treatment and surgery were no longer effective. Ted had trouble staying in one place for too long. He walked around his home and garden at a great pace, and this did not let up even when his wound was extensive, very painful, and life-threatening in nature, being close to an artery. His GP was reluctant to refer him to hospice services despite repeated requests by IDEA services and the manager. District nursing was supporting for dressing changes a few times every week. Eventually, after a lot of following up and advocating for more support, he was referred to hospice for pain management advice. For most of us, this type of wound and pain would really slow us down, likely put us in bed and out of action. We could easily express our distress and pain, but not for Ted. His compromised cognition was incongruent with any self-management of symptoms and was severely restricting his ability to moderate his daily routines or adhere to his new care regimes. The whole situation was very distressing for his extremely devoted support staff and service manager involved. Sadly, due to everyone being so distressed and feeling out of their depth, Ted transitioned to an aged residential facility with a hospital-level care program following an acute hospital admission for a hemorrhage. It would have been very helpful to have specialised symptom relief advice early in the diagnosis. It would have been very helpful to have access to coaching and training for our staff via appropriate referrals and early engagement, helping everyone prepare for the disease trajectory and plan accordingly. This situation was extremely distressing for our support workers and Ted's housemates, and I'm sure for Ted as well. This is a perfect example of how early engagement and community partnerships, starting with the GP, IDEA services, DHB, and right through to palliative care services, really needed to work together, even when it was difficult and complex, not to push it into the too hard basket. Sadly, we were unable in this case to support Ted to die with dignity in his own home. As an organisation with national reach, we see and experience DHB, PHO and palliative care variation, which can make it more difficult to establish what exactly is available for each community. I'll hand back to Prue now to talk about what the next steps may be and to summarise our presentation.
Thanks, Kim. So moving on to slide 12. We are currently reviewing the residential facilities that support our older people. How can we improve health outcomes and better prepare for the palliative care and end-of-life journey for people? How can we improve the knowledge and understanding of the workforce and managers that support these services? We have a commitment to review and align our policies and procedures with latest best practice. And to achieve this, we will need to work with the people we support, their families and whānau, and in collaboration with external stakeholders. To offer the best possible journey for the people we support, we have an appreciation that embracing government, DHB and PHO initiatives such as primary options, hospital at home and services closer to the home and other health alliances will be essential. We would like to develop a national approach to our support workers attending the hospice facilitated workshops, upskilling our workforce in advance of need. Moving to slide 13. This is the start of a new way to approach palliative care for the people we support. We can continue to build on great local relationships that are already in place and reflect on the wonderful journeys already had for those we have supported. With hospice services having a deeper understanding about intellectual disability and IDEA services having a realistic understanding of palliative care services available in their communities, relationships can develop further. In West Auckland, our team have been learning more about the POI program, and one of our service managers has been part of a focus group looking at patient experiences on behalf of the people he is supporting. We know that in some areas we have day programs, which we would like to be part of and have access to short stay inpatient services when appropriate to stabilise people's conditions and symptoms. And currently, this is rare for us. We'd like to work collaboratively to develop targeted staff and carer learning modules and the development of easy read resources about such topics as advanced care planning, hospice services and palliative care. The Health Quality Safety Commission have come to IHC and presented their advanced care plan program to us, and we have agreed to work together to ensure that intellectual disability are represented in resources and videos moving forward. So moving to slide 14 in summary. We have learnt a lot from our past and from international models of support for this population. We are planning for our future, and we have an ageing population with health inequalities that require significant support and advocacy. We need to work across the community and secondary services to build relationships and grow the understanding around intellectual disabilities and the specific health and wellbeing needs to ensure more positive outcomes. The way we work will be person-centred, responsive, and in partnership with you. It's always our preference to give our service users the option to die comfortably at home, supported by the staff they know and the people who know them well, particularly our older service users who have been with us for many years. In order to achieve that and be responsive to their changing needs and provide effective and safe support, we must have the necessary wraparound clinical expertise that the people we support are entitled to, like everyone else in the community. Collaboration and understanding is the goal. So Kim and I would like to thank you for this opportunity to share our passion for working with and for people with intellectual disability. Thank you.